You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I'm thrilled to welcome back Scott Klasowski, our guest to chat about technology. Scott, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back. I'm feeling particularly illuminating today.
Well, that's good. That's exactly what our listeners need. So I'm going to start off with a fun question from the teenagers that I polled in reference to the bot that Microsoft launched a couple of years ago called Tay, that within 16 hours had to be shut down because it became racist and misogynistic and incredibly rude. You know, when people say, should we worry about AI? I think this is an example that had a lot of people talking about how AI can go rogue and how that could, you know, we've created machines that could destroy us. What's your opinion on that whole event and how it relates to AI?
It's a great case study. You know, it's a step, one step of a million steps of understanding what happens when you have self-learning AIs. You know, the key here is it wasn't just an AI. It was a self-learning AI. And I think it was, you know, great that they, you know, put it out and attempted to see what would happen. You know, unfortunately, with a self-learning AI that is building its own rules based on content that it's fed, and that content could, think of it, content or data, whether it's structured or unstructured data, it doesn't matter, right? But this AI was fed content that was racist and misogynistic. And so because it was fed content like that, it knew no better. It knew no better than to create rules that ended up making it be racist. You know, it is an age old thing where we used to say garbage in, garbage out. But that, you know, that used to be, we used to think about it as in terms of data and applications. It's the same rule with a self-learning AI, is that if a self-learning AI feeds itself on bad data or, you know, even unstructured content that is not true, hate-filled, you know, whatever, then the AI will know no better than to build rules and then behave badly. So it was a great example of that. And, you know, like I said, it's one step of a million steps of trying to do things with self-learning AIs and learning lessons.
So when you talk about self-learning AIs, how does that apply? For example, in the last episode, you used the example of radiology and how AI is getting much better at detecting cancer than the human eye because they have so many millions of examples that they're learning from. Are those not self-learning AIs?
That's a great question, and I'm going to illuminate the answer for you on this one. When I say self-learning, there's probably a couple different levels of that. You know, we use terms like machine learning and deep learning, and those are actually different. So, you know, something that is deep learning is building its own rules really without much human involvement, other than we are feeding it the data. Okay? Machine learning, usually humans are playing more of a role because they might be constantly correcting the AI. So every time the AI makes a decision, the human might correct the decision, and the AI goes, oh, okay, well, I better create a new rule because Ronit told me this is wrong. So machine learning has more human participation. That's an easy way to think about it. But the machine still might be building some rules, just not completely on its own. Deep learning is different. Deep learning, you know, in a radiology example, you're feeding a deep learning AI a million x-rays. And you're saying, look at these million x-rays, and we can define what a fracture is for you. And now look at these million x-rays, and you write your own rules about if it is fractured or not. Okay, and so in this case, again, the human is choosing the data to feed it. And so that's where you get into an interesting thing, where if we feed it x-rays that are slanted, so let's just say we fed it a million x-rays of male wrist fractures, male, but not female. Okay, and then you go to run the AI, and then what you find out is, well, the AI doesn't diagnose female, you know, or wrist fractures in females quite as well. Well, is that the AI's fault? I mean, the human who fed it did not fed it a good sampling of data. And so it knew no better than to create rules that ended up being biased towards males. So, you know, hopefully that I made that kind of simple without using a bunch of techie language, right? But it's a really interesting question in the healthcare space, you know, in anything where the outcome or the prediction or the diagnosis is really critical. You know, in other words, it's going to cause a heavy medical procedure or it's going to cause a heavy amount of behavior, you know, changes. It's really important to understand if you're going to depend on an AI, how was that AI built? You know, where did the rules come from? Because if you build an AI, Ronit, and I think you are, you know, very, very brilliant and very wise. If you build an AI, it's still going to have your bias. It may have your bias as a woman. It might have your bias because of your age. It might have your bias as a Caucasian, you know, and you may not even know that, you know. And so that's an interesting thing I think we're always going to have to wonder about with AIs is we need them. They can help us a lot. We're always going to have to ask ourselves, well, who built the rules?
Right. So that brings me to another question, because Cognoa is a company that has just launched a diagnostic app for autism. Well, they concluded their research, they had good results, and now they've applied to the FDA for approval. And so it's a diagnostic, it's an app that takes information from parents and caregivers and looks at videos of the child and diagnoses the child with autism. Now, there's a lot of skepticism in the clinical community because they're saying this is just going to pick up a lot of high-risk behaviors and not necessarily diagnose autism. Now, historically, when we look at the diagnosis of autism, the diagnostic criteria were built on the characteristics of boys, because when the disorder was first categorized, it was 11 boys. And the rate is currently in the research is 4 boys to 1 girl are diagnosed with autism. As we're doing more research, we're finding out that actually the rates are higher for women, but they're not being diagnosed because they show up with different characteristics. They're much more social. They're able to imitate social behaviors much better than the boys are. And so they don't check the box on the criteria for diagnosis. So when I look at this, and the research said that the app is diagnosing across gender, across race, you know, across ethnicity much better than we've had historically. So I think this is a great move forward because we're missing so many girls and women who get diagnosed much later in life. And of course, we have long waiting lists where people can wait up to 2 years to see a diagnostician, which means you're missing out on the opportunity to capitalize on brain plasticity and brain development in the first 5 years of life, because currently kids are getting diagnosed at about 4.5 years old. And so if this tool is used as a screening by pediatricians at 6 months old and 12 months old, we can catch kids a lot earlier. So I think this is a great move forward. But exactly what you were talking to, right? There's bias involved and people are concerned that this is not, you know, that this is not necessarily a good move and that the human eye and observation is better.
Well, it's a great question. And that's a great example of what we're talking about. I have many thoughts on this. I mean, first of all, I agree with you. It's a great step forward. I appreciate if people have concerns, you know, about a machine doing diagnosis of something like autism. I appreciate what they're saying, which is, you know, a very skilled diagnostic, you know, clinician is able to pick up on a lot of data that maybe a machine wouldn't be able to pick up on. You know, the flush of the skin, or, you know, really specific eye behavior, you know, or just a tone of voice, or right. So I appreciate that. And I don't want to automatically always say, oh, you know, an AI is going to be able to make a better diagnostic than a human every time. You know, even though I'm a technologist, that isn't where I come from, you know, that belief. Now, with that said, what I believe is in many, many situations in the world, an AI is going to gradually over time become more accurate than a human being at making a diagnosis or making a decision. So the reason I believe that is humans have a set of rules that we go by. So the most gifted diagnostic, you know, person of anything in the world just has a set of rules that they have learned over time. And they may not even be able to describe all the rules. They could describe some of them, but they have a set of rules that they're going through. It is not magic. You know, I don't believe that they were gifted by God and God said, well, you're going to be able to diagnose, you know, women with autism better than anyone else because I've given you a God gifts of skill, right? I don't believe that's how it works, although I believe in God and I believe God gives us gifts. You know, I believe that we develop a set of rules. The fact that we develop a set of rules would lead you to believe that you can build an AI, you can build a machine that also has a set of rules. But the difference is that set of rules can have the best practices across 100 different human beings. And it can test those rules out over thousands and thousands of patients, way more than any one person, one human being could test the rules out. Oh, and it can get better and better and better for decades. And humans aren't going to get better and better and better for decades. Eventually, we expire. So I tend to look at these things in short range and long range. Okay. In the short range, an AI that can diagnose something that is as subtle as the field that you're working in, I say, hey, you know what? In the early days, it may be fairly effective. It may not be more effective than some humans. It may be more effective than some humans. But in the early days, it is still a baby and it is still learning. I believe that within, you know, some amount of years, you put better and better sensors on that AI, and those sensors will be able to gather data humans can't even gather. Minute changes in the eyeball, right? You know, changes in temperature over the body. You know, I mean, the sensors will be able to pick up data humans can't even pick up. Okay, we'll mix that with a diagnostic AI. Now it's got better information than a human, any human would have. Okay, well, now maybe it's, let's just say, 10% better than any human. Okay, well, now move it forward a decade, two decades. Let it see a million possible patients. Now it is by far better than any human. So I say all that to say, you know, I think there's a short range view and a long range view. And what I get frustrated with are people who immediately get panicked and this is terrible. And, you know, we shouldn't be using a tool like this to diagnose autism today. That's ridiculous. That is a very, in my opinion, kind of Cro-Magnon view of the world of, come on, man. First of all, it will be better at some point. Maybe it can't be as good as everybody, but in certain parts of the world where you don't even have anybody who can do a diagnosis, it's going to be better than nothing. You know, like you said, people who can't afford to get the high-end diagnosis, it's better than nothing. You know, and it's going to learn. And every year it'll get better. And then there will become a point where I would trust it more than I would trust the best clinician. But we're never going to get there unless you relax a little bit on the fact that you got to start somewhere.
Right, right. That's a really good point that it's in its infancy and it's learning. I mean, as you were talking, I'm thinking about the top diagnostician at UCLA who retired a few years ago. And so she spent 50 years researching this, studying it, diagnosing kids, and all that information goes with her, right? Whereas an AI learns these rules and just keeps building and building and building on the data set and becomes really powerful.
True, at some extent. You know, now she passed on a lot of those rules. Right? She passed on, but there's no way that a human being can pass on everything that they know. They just can't. You hope that if you mentor somebody and you pour into them for years, that maybe they can get past you. You know, they take what they can from you and then they get past you. But the reality is, you know, I can't teach somebody to know everything I know about technology. I can't.
Right, right.
First of all, I've been around longer than most of the people that want to know. How do I teach a 25-year-old, you know, what it was like when my dad programmed for Boeing on punch cards? You know, how do I teach that person what it was like when I learned to program in BASIC? You know, how do I give them a perspective that took me years to learn? I can't. And it's the same way with the but so you're right. An AI is perpetual. Everything it learns is forever. And it is only going to improve if we feed it better data and more data. And your example of males versus females on diagnosis is so perfect because, you know, if today you just said you take traditional wisdom today and you dump it into an AI, it's going to be biased, right? But in 10 years, when enough people wake up to, wait a minute, you know, how you diagnose a woman versus a male or a female versus a male, and you feed that data in, okay. You know, and, you know, now it is not biased anymore. But does that mean that I'm upset because the company that you mentioned, they're today, they still are heavily kind of male specific with their diagnosis? No, you got to start somewhere. Right, building the AI. You got to build the platform somewhere. And every time a company jumps in and tries, I give them an A for effort. You know, I give them an A for effort. And like, you know, thank God for you that you are trying. And then I hope in 10 years you have the best tool and you're rewarded financially for your work. Because your first 4 or 5 years, people aren't going to like you. People are going to say your AI is flawed and broken. You know, you're not going to be able to get as much money because the traditional healthcare system or mental care system won't trust you, believe in you, or want to invest in you. You know, so, you know, God bless you for trying it. And I hope that you can stick it out and you get the rewards later on.
Okay, great. Well, let's pivot as we're talking about AI to the smart home. We use the phrase smart home all the time. What does that mean to you as a technologist?
Oh, yeah. Once again, get ready to be enlightened. All right. I'm all over this one. First of all, I words are important, and I abhor the way that we use words in technology. And so I swear to you, there's some basement somewhere where marketing people get together and name things in the technology space that then screw up our lives. And to call something smart is such a misnomer at this point, you know, or any time for the last 20 years that we've said smart home, it is a lie, right? What we have had is a connected home. And there's a huge difference between the word connected and smart. So my first thought when somebody says to me, you know, hey, what do you think of smart homes? It's like, nope, it's not smart. It's not smart yet. It's just a baby now. It's starting to become, you know, have a little intelligence. It's connected. It's connected to the internet. And some of the devices are connected to each other and they're connected to your mobile app. We have connected homes today. We don't have smart homes. That's my first comment. My second comment is, set aside my bias towards words. You know, I have spent way too much money in this house that we are in right now, that I am in right now. We have built this entire smart home here on Control 4 and then mixing in Alexa and, you know, Echo and then mixing in a couple of other things, you know, that can all be connected to the Control 4 backbone. You know, just to give you an idea of how ridiculous this is, Rooney, we got hit by lightning about a year ago.
Oh, wow.
And it burned out all the cool stuff that we had here at our house. Everything, like televisions, garbage disposal, it just burned it all out. So the insurance people, very kind folks, said, you know, hey, just give us a list of everything that's burned out and, you know, we'll fix it all. I think, great. So one of the things on the list was our entire smart home ecosystem. And so I wasn't paying a lot of attention, to be honest. You know, I knew my wife, Annette, was taking care of everything with the insurance. She was hiring getting the vendors to come fix everything. You know, I fixed some things by myself, but it was like I fixed the garbage disposal because I was annoyed that I couldn't use the garbage disposal one day, right? But I didn't take on the rebuilding the whole smart home. So one day she goes, oh, well, you know, go up and look upstairs in one of the rooms up there at what they did. Well, they had taken kind of a mishmash of equipment from around our house and they built it into a rack. And there was a ceiling to floor rack filled with electronics. And, you know, a couple of days after that, they got it all working. And so, I mean, at this home, we can turn on the fireplace with our phones. We can turn on any lights anywhere with our phones. We can set the air conditioner with the phones. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. We can turn on music in any room, you know, turn on any TV, and we can do it all from anywhere in the world. You know, it's just stupid, right? But, you know, this is the field I'm in. So I wanted to be able to answer people's questions about smart homes. And part of the end of that story that's so ridiculous was after they did it all, I hadn't thought about it, but I asked Annette, I said, how much did it cost to rebuild the smart home? This is not the televisions. This is literally just the smart home infrastructure. And she goes, oh, it was $40,000. Right? And so that's the level of smart home I have here. Now, I know that's not most people, right? Most people are buying smart lights or smart, you know, door knobs for the front door or Nest devices for their heat and air. So today, most people have a connected home. I have a very connected home, and I am trying to start to make it smart. And what I mean by that is I now want the home to start to have some awareness that it rained. And if it rained, I want the home to be smart enough to say, well, let's not run our sprinkler systems today. And I don't even want it to talk to me. I just want it to tell me, hey, I'm not going to run the sprinkler systems today. Okay, big guy. Right. That's all that makes my home smart. Okay. You know, or if somebody is walking around in our backyard between the hours of 10 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning, right? It's a smart home when all the backyard lights go on and recordings start and I get an alert notification that there's somebody in my backyard, right? Then I start to say, okay, well, now the home is smart. So I would just wrap it up with this. We're starting to have really good equipment. We're starting to cross the line between just a connected home and a smart home, a home that can think, a home that knows what to do. I'm excited about that. I'm excited about buildings being smart, because all they've been is connected for years up to this point. When I think about healthcare, when I think about the world of autism and what a smart home is going to be able to do to help people, I get excited about what the possibilities are. So, you know, hopefully that foundation sets up any other conversation you want to have now, right, about smart homes.
Right. So an example of smart would be the refrigerator that monitors when it's running low and orders, does the shopping itself online.
Right.
Just notifies you, right? You're out of eggs and milk and I've ordered it.
Yeah. You know, and if we wanted to play around with words, you're right. If the refrigerator is just connected to the internet and I can just look on an app and, you know, see if it's running or check its temperature or, you know, something like that, it's not smart. It's just connected. If the refrigerator can tell me what's expired because it senses gases being released from Tupperware, okay, it's starting to have some education right there, right? I mean, it's starting to be something more than just a connected refrigerator. When it orders, is it smart or is it just kind of educated? You know, if I've told it, look, if the milk ever gets below this amount or if the butter disappears from the refrigerator, then reorder. You know, is that smart? I don't know. It's an educated refrigerator, right? A smart refrigerator would look at my wearable, look at my weight, look at my sugar levels. And my refrigerator would say, I have purposely thrown out the ice cream, the high sugary things. Sorry if you're upset, but I've noticed that, you know, your sugar levels are too high. You are welcome. Right now, that's a smart refrigerator.
Unlike my neighbor who has a padlock on the ice cream, so her husband won't eat it. Yeah. She literally bought little ice cream container things that padlock, so he can't get into it. So you referenced helping people with disabilities. I mean, if you think about somebody in a wheelchair, if you think about somebody with autism who maybe has safety concerns, you know, kids with autism tend to get away through a door, run away. That's kind of a frequent behavior, run to water, which creates the danger of drowning, you know, general safety concerns. If you think about going on vacation with a child who has a disability, now you're in an unfamiliar home. How do you know that the doors are locked? How do you know when somebody got out the house? How do you know, you know, what applications are there that you can think of for people with those kinds of challenges?
Two things. All right. First of all, there's a combination of a smart home and a wearable device for somebody with autism. And so I'm just going to tell you the picture I see in my head, right, to answer this question. What I see in my head is coming is a wearable device that's got at least 30 or 40 sensors. And those sensors would be everything from, you know, the physical sensors to obviously the GPS location, but also sound. Now, I have a new, you know, I think you and I might have talked about it. I'm wearing the new Amazon Halo, right? And the Amazon Halo measures my tone of voice.
I was going to ask you about that at the end here, how that training is working.
Yeah. So, I don't want to go into a Halo conversation, but my point is it listens to my words and it listens to my tone of voice. It listens to both. Well, I mean, we're starting to have all the technology. When you say we have motion detectors, We have sound identifiers. We have smell identifiers. Like, we have all the sensors we need to create a home that could be safe, right? That could be taught. What are the boundaries, because I have a child or I have somebody that has an issue, right? What are the boundaries that I'm looking for? You know, I'm looking for somebody who is yelling. I'm looking for somebody that breaches the inside or the outside of the home during these hours. You know, I'm looking for just, you know, any loud noise. I'm looking for somebody who's in a place they shouldn't be in the home. You know, with the right sensor package, which sounds like, oh my gosh, I got to build a sensor array, you know, at my home. I don't think it's going to be that big a deal. I think we're not too far away from, you're going to go put a little sensor that's, you know, 1 inch by 1 inch into every room. And those sensors are all going to immediately talk to each other. And those sensors will sense 8, 10 different things. Each sensor will be about $50. And those sensors will all go to a central AI. And then I will just program the AI to say, here is the safety and security I'm looking for. And then, by the way, the person who does not have the band on, you know, might be treated differently than the person that has the band on. Right. And you might say, oh, well, what if my autistic child takes the band off? It's like, well, there's solutions for that. You're going to put on a band they can't take off. Right. You know, which you're going to need to do that because you don't ever want them to take it off. All right. So now I can discern, well, who's in the house who has a band and who doesn't. I can have a whole different set of rules for the individual that has the band or doesn't. All right. If you will submit for a second that that may be a good future, because I just don't think we're that far from being able to technically do that, right? Then when you say the person with autism goes to another house, well, as long as they have that band, it does allow us to do some things like, okay, I've got the band and then I have a station, like a base station. And I can just take the base station when I travel, and the base station says, if this person gets more than 50 yards or 50 feet away from the base station, bells and whistles go off all over the place, right? I mean, the base station listens for the same kinds of activity, right? A scream of help or just a scream of pain or just a scream. And right, I think we could build a base station that's like an amped up Amazon Echo, right? An amped up Alexa. That instead of listening for you to say Alexa, it's just listening to the band. So nothing that I am saying right now is Star Trek. Everything that I'm saying right now, if you're an engineer and you wanted to try to put it together, it could be built.
Yeah, I mean, my son's in Asia, and when he left, he had to quarantine for 2 weeks. They had something similar. He had a band he couldn't take off. He had to set the perimeter of his room. And if he violated that perimeter, the alarm went off and called the authorities. I mean, this is for COVID quarantine, right? It checked his temperature throughout the day and reported back. It had access to his camera and his microphone so they could see and hear what he was doing. I mean, there was full-on monitoring going on during quarantine.
Yeah. And so I say, you know, I think a lot of times people who are not in the technology field, they will hear us talk about things like this and they'll say that, you know, hey, it sounds like Star Trek. I mean, it really does sound like science fiction. And, you know, when you're in the technology field, you know the sensors that are already out there. You know, you can see the future of what does an Amazon Echo look like 10 years from now? You know, I mean, we haven't had them for barely 5 years, you know, and look what they do. What are they going to look like in 10 years? I think it's harder, you know, I call civilians, right? When you're a non-technologist, you're a civilian. I think it's just hard to understand what we are going to be able to do with people who have autism. And there is no question in my mind, it's going to be a combination of a wearable, sensors, and an AI. You put those three things together and you're going to be able to configure an environment which is safe. You're going to be able to configure an environment that also, you know, maybe also can help correct behavior or help people learn. I mean, you're going to be able to structure an environment in a way we just don't do today. And I think that'll be wonderful.
So linking back to the beginning of our conversation, where we talked about this bot that went rogue, you know, some of the concerns people have is that you create the smart home and then it can be hacked. There can be, you know, technological terrorism. Somebody can take over all of our homes. They could take over an entire community, an entire city, a county, and just shut everything down. How do you address that?
Wow, you were a downer today. Jeez. here we were talking about dreams of the future, and it was so exciting. And then wah, wah. Right?
Well, you know, that's what people are going to be thinking.
Yeah. No. And honestly, it is. It's a good question.
I've got friends, Scott, who play tricks on their wives in 6 months ago when they were flying. You know, he's in the airplane changing the temperature of the house that she's in and turning it to like the air conditioning to 60 degrees in winter, you know, and so it's not that far-fetched.
No, it's funny. I've never done that. I've thought about it because, you know, we have so much control over the home. I've thought about doing that to Annette, but I did not think that there would be anything that would be funny enough that I'm going to risk what she might do, right? You know, when I get home. Anytime we advance technology, we advance the potential attack surface, you know, what's called the attack surface. The more sensors you put in a home, the more your privacy could be invaded, because if somebody gets access to all that data, they're going to learn things about you. You know, it is the other side of technology progress. For example, I know you're going to be all over this, right? But this Amazon Halo I have on, you can take a picture of yourself in your underwear, and then it does your body fat. And then if you take a picture of yourself in your underwear every 2 weeks, it'll show how your body has changed, right? And if your body fat level has changed, you know, from week to week. And so I've been doing that. And so the other day I showed it to my wife and my daughter, you know, and I could see the quizzical look on their face of, well, that's kind of cool. It's not only that. You take a picture of yourself in your underwear and it gives you a slide bar that you can go up and down with your fat levels, and it shows you what you would look like.
Oh. Right?
So let's say you have 20% body fat. You can slide it down to 12% and see what you would look like. I mean, that's cool, right? And I showed it to them and I could see in their face, right, that they were like, well, that's cool, but I have to take pictures of myself in my underwear, right?
And then Amazon has those photographs.
And then, yeah, and then Amazon swears up and down it's encrypted and they don't have those pictures of me in my underwear. But, right, you know, do you trust that? Now, I could care less if Amazon has pictures of me in my underwear, right? I could care less. There is actually zero distinguishing characteristics about me, you know, that I would care about. You know, they could post it online. It's not going to hurt my reputation, right? Now you may feel differently, right, about you. So, but my point is, you know, that's a cool advancement in technology, right? You know, it really was kind of neat for me to be able to see, you know, week to week, was my body changing at all? You know, do the slide bar, see what it might look like. You know, like one of the things I'm going to experiment with is I have never tried to hold my stomach in. You know, I mean, I just get up there and let my stomach hang out, and it shoots, and it gives me a fat percentage. So next time, just to test it, I'm going to like tense my stomach and strike the pose that as if I was on the cover of a magazine. I'm not going to lie to the Amazon Halo. I'm just going to say, okay, well, this is me if I actually tense my six pack, right? And then see what it does then, right? So anyway, there's another side of technology. Yes, the smart home. Well, I told you, we got hit by lightning. We couldn't even turn on the heat and air this place. I mean, we were panicked. You know, because everything that we do, you know, you couldn't turn on a TV even if it one worked, because everything was controlled by the master control for brain upstairs. So there is always a trade-off in security, privacy. You know, those things are always a trade-off. And I'd love to tell you that we are getting so good at security, you don't have to worry about any of this. And I'm not going to tell you that. What I'm going to tell you is it's a trade-off. You put more and more technology on your body, in your home. You have more and more risk that somebody will penetrate that technology, and then, you know, Lord knows what could happen. And I think you just have to be, you know, wise on the other side of it is, do I care? You know, do I really care that much? If, like I told you, I could care less if it gets out, you know, a picture of me in my underwear.
So is the feedback that you're getting from the Halo changing your behavior? Is it motivating you and changing either your how you eat, how you exercise, how you speak with your tone of voice? Are you becoming more self-aware?
Yes. And again, in the world of looking into the future, I mean, it does four things, right? It does the body measurement, it checks your sleep, it does a sleep histogram, your tone of voice, and then activity, right? It checks your activity. When I look at those four things, the sleep probably has made me the most, you know, aware of, okay, I need to go to bed a little bit earlier. You know, I need to get a little more sleep. Because it not only shows you good, bad, you know, great, how much you slept, it shows the histogram of deep sleep, REM sleep, light sleep, right? And so with all that information, I'm able to say, hey, there's certain days like today where I'm feeling very illuminated. If you would have caught me 2 days ago, I would have said, can we cancel? Right? but I know the reason why was I didn't get a very good night's sleep at all. I, you know, only got 3 hours of sleep or whatever. And so, yes, like, things like that do change my behavior. The body fat percentage, I don't know. You know, I'm still on the fence yet about whether I'm going to buckle down just to make it happy. I'm going to try sucking my stomach in first, see how that works. The tone of voice thing is really intriguing because generally my tone is not happy. According to how it rates, and it's not, again, it's not just tone, it's the words you use. So there's three levels. And generally, I'm heaviest if it's not a neutral tone, because I have a neutral tone 90% of the day. But when it's not neutral, the heaviest are the bottom two ratings. And people around me, I've showed it to them, and they're all laughing at me. Right. And so it's making me thoughtful that maybe I'm a bit intense. You know, and that I come across more intense than I feel, because it doesn't show my tone as being happy, you know, or, you know, confident, you know, and either it's getting it wrong, right? Or maybe I hear myself different than I come across to other people. So it's making me think about things like that.
I mean, that's great. If it brings self-awareness, it'll be interesting to see if it actually brings change in behavior, right? I used one of those sleep tracker. It was before the one I have right now, the Garmin. It was a different one. And it kept telling me that I was having very poor quality sleep. And it stressed me out so much because I was sleeping. I wasn't waking up during the night, but every morning it would say you had 90 minutes of good sleep, that it just increased my stress level to the point where I just stopped wearing it because I was feeling okay and I was sleeping, but the app was telling me that the quality of my sleep was really poor.
Well, again, early days. You know, for some of these devices and AIs, and you know, if it's
yeah, this was probably like 7 years ago. So
yeah, I mean, if something's not working for you, wait until it gets better or try a different one. You know, I've tried a few different things as far as sleep monitoring. This one's the best one I've ever had so far because it doesn't just say good, bad. You know, you had 6 hours of good sleep. It gives you literally a histogram, and so I'm able to look and say, okay, I went to sleep and I immediately went into deep sleep and. And then I was in light sleep and then REM and then I was awake for a second. And then, you know, so I'm looking at that histogram and saying, all right, well, you know, what is causing me to spend more time in deep sleep or REM sleep? So I've started, for instance, listening to a meditation podcast thing right before I go to sleep. Right. And I've noticed that changes a little bit the histogram. And so it will change my behavior because I'm going to really play around with what do I do the last 30 minutes. You know, before I go to sleep, in order, you know, to have the best kind of sleep.
So, for fun, in closing, if you had one capability from a smart home, anything you want, what would it be?
Anything that I don't have now, or that yes. Okay, all right. So, something that I don't have now. Wow, I know there. I got to think about what thing I would want the most. You know, it would probably be around entertainment, and it would probably be an intelligent AI that I could talk to, and it would play the exact right music or the exact right movies or shows in the exact right place in the exact right way. So, you know, I have some, like I told you, I got speakers in every room, and they're separated by room. You know, and I've got Alexa's, Amazon Echoes in multiple rooms. I have a Apple, you know, iHome or whatever here in this office. And all of them play music, right? But they're on different ecosystems. And so I can't just say play acoustic music and all of them know what I'm talking about. you know, when I do play music, the volume's always wrong in the room, and I have to adjust the volume to the right thing. And so I think for me, it would probably be, I would like my house to be alive, like alive with me being able to communicate to it how I want to be entertained. And so I want to be able to say, hey, you know, give me some mood lighting and I'd like some Jim Croce, you know, at 20 decibels, right? Yeah, I mean, I want to be able to just communicate like that and boom, I get what I want.
That must be on the horizon.
Well, I think we're headed towards it. Just like we talked about early days on a lot of things. I mean, I can play music in every room. I can change the volume. You know, I can pick out music sometimes, you know, what I want. You know, it isn't consistent across Apple Music and Amazon Music, right? You know, unfortunately, my playlists aren't. You know, so we're a chunk of the way there. You know, what I need is an AI that is not an Alexa. I need a home AI that I can talk to that sits on top of all this stuff, right? And once I can talk to it and say, hey, I'm in this mood, right? I'm in a country mood. I'm in a folk music mood. I'm in a classical mood. Once I can say that and it knows what to play, right? The next step for me is that it starts to sense and understand. And I don't even hardly have to talk to it. Or it just asks me. Like when I wake up in the morning and I go into the bathroom to get ready, right? The AI would just say, good morning, Scott. You know, what would you like to hear? And I would go, I'm in a country mood. And it knows exactly what that means. And it says, all right, here's some new country. And it knows how loud to play it because it's morning. I don't want it to be real loud. And, you know, it's an AI. Sits on top of everything and runs my entertainment.
Sounds like the perfect partner.
Yes. It would be great for introverts.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much. Very enlightening and lots of fun. I appreciate it. And I look forward to next time.
All right. Sounds good. I look forward to those questions from the teenagers. Those are always great. And some of your other difficult questions about how we should think about things.
Yeah. I have a lot of screenager questions for you coming up.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.